Hello and welcome to the CG Garage, episode number 6, brought to you by the Chaos Group. Happy New Year, everyone. Very happy with this new year. These podcasts have been going really well. Very excited about it. This one's a pretty good one as well. We recorded it just before the new year with Kevin Margot and Darren Ross. Both those guys happen to work at Blur, but they've also worked together on some shorts and some independent projects together. Kevin is directing, and Darren has been acting, doing motion capture, animation just supervising, animation directing. And he's kind of an interesting guy as well. So I figured it'd be cool to bring the two of them in and talk about how they've worked together both at Blur and on their independent projects. So we talk about stuff they've worked on at Blur and how they came up with some new ideas of doing filmmaking, how they carried that across in the short they did called Grounded, and what they're doing now on Construct. Darren's a really interesting person. He actually has a lot of acting training that he's done, as well as some martial arts training, fight choreography. He's got a lot of training with fight guys, and that's going to become an important part of Construct. And then Kevin, of course, has been working away on directing and sort of pushing the technology that's possible with directing. So overall, it was a really interesting chat, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. Sorry, the intro is a little long, but I want to make sure that you guys had a good understanding of what these guys are talking about, because we kind of go all over the place in this podcast, and hopefully you guys can follow along. All right. Thanks a lot, guys. Enjoy.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
It's like a radio station. It's nice.
It's nice, right? Have you guys done interviews before?
Oh, yeah. Him and I ran around for during his Grounded.
We did a few.
Did a bunch of.
Yeah, we did a radio interview for
talks. And, you know.
So Grounded. You guys worked on Grounded, right?
Yes, together.
Yeah.
How long ago was that?
2011. Started in 2010. We're recording?
Yeah, we're recording.
Oh, get out. This unofficial,
natural,
like,
man.
All right, let's go. Yeah. 2010, fall 2010. Around that time at Blur, we were working on the Batman Arkham City cinematic, and the 5Ds were kind of new. And
oh, right. So this is during the DSLR phase of where things were starting to get really interesting.
Yep. And on this Batman Arkham City cinematic, we explored a lot of new things in terms of the process and, like, kind of the previous front end, but then also a lot of the technical execution of, we had a virtual avatar of Darren here using the MOVA process and the scanned head. He was getting tortured in this chair in a basement by this sadistic...
This was for Batman?
This was for Batman, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And Hugo Strange.
Hugo Strange was the bad guy.
I was the Tiger Guard captain of his mercenary crew.
Right.
He was torturing me to find out if I told Batman his name.
Yep.
Nice.
And it basically, that project served as a motivation for, you know, us to explore some new tech. Like, we used MOVA for the first time. We really focused on, like, facial performance. And, you know, the other thing we did was, in the previous process, it was like a minute of just basically a guy in a chair getting tortured. So how do you previs that, like, just with an animatic and make it feel like really potent and powerful and, you know, gritty? Well, we decided to take these new DSLRs that we had just bought and, like, retrofit the library into this dark, interrogation room.
Right.
And lit everything all dramatically, and then just got all these, like, you know, cool slow lenses that would go down to like 2 or 1/8 or whatever, and just like went to town and shot minutes of footage of Darren just getting, you know, tortured. And then, you know, the next day or two, like our layout artist editorial had cut all this together, and we had this really cool looking previs of what would then become, you know, months later, the final cinematic. And that experience for me, like, really, you know, I was starting to get into this live action. I was curious about it. It was really great working with Darren on that.
Darren has an I mean, obviously you have an experience in animation, but obviously you were being an actor at the same time, right?
Yeah. So, yeah.
And that's a little bit different in a sense.
I had been studying acting.
Right.
And I'd been involved in motion capture for years for the studio, but then I left Blur for about a year to go work with, I have a mentor who I trained with, who's an ex-Navy SEAL who had a show on Discovery Channel called Future Weapons.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted me to go on the road with him on the show and work in the production with him on the show and kind of be his right-hand guy and help him produce and make the show. And there was a lot of live-action experience with that, and I actually got thrown into some of the episodes playing a terrorist
right
here and there. And when I came back from that experience, came back to Blur, I was getting asked to act in a lot of different things, and I said, you know what, I should take the acting more seriously and mm-hmm. started training in it more formally and jumping into it more in the motion capture.
So that's basically you're sort of blending the idea of being an animation supervisor and actually just really acting it out at the same time. And that was kind of a unique thing for you, I guess.
Yeah, that project was really great because we do so much action, and there's action in that project, but it was really cool to be asked by Tim to go, hey, you know, we want to try this new MOBA thing for the facial capture. Mm-hmm. It's a very different thing. It's actually going to capture your likeness. I want you to play this mercenary character.
And, right.
You know, I'm like, yeah, that sounds great. And we had to formally submit my likeness to, you know, the Warner Brothers, the WB guys.
Right.
And we worked with Ames Kirshen, we've been working with him since before he was with DC. He was with Marvel.
Right.
And submitted it to him, and he turned it over to their people to approve me as the character as well, and approve my voice, too, because it was a very challenging character because literally the torturing and all the stuff would be very challenging to either work with somebody else's voice, which I've done before a lot in facial capture.
Sure.
Or vice versa, have an actor try and match what I was doing,
so
facial and body.
You did both. You did the
so,
voice.
Yeah, it made it a lot easier to be able to do both.
Right.
So that was cool. And working with Kevin when we were doing the previs was awesome because we had done some previs before for projects. I think we had done Star Wars before that. We'd shot some live action previs for that.
This I think we kind of gave it an aesthetic attention, you know, with lighting and using like good lenses and everything.
Yes, exactly.
That was on the Batman project.
Yes, right? Yeah.
And then you guys carried that through for Grounded as well.
So that kind of led to it. I was like, I saw a lot of great acting and like emotive, you know, capabilities with Darren, mm-hmm. and at the same time that I had started to explore photography and then this DSLR filmmaking stuff and like generating a lot of these ideas for Grounded. And I knew at some point I'd need to get an actor involved to play the lead astronaut and the only astronaut. And so I went to Darren and I showed him a lot of what my buddy Barrett and I, who also co-directed it, mm-hmm. what we had prepared already and went to Darren about it and he jumped on board and then we moved forward with the project.
I mean, that was a really substantial short, obviously. It got a lot of amazing attention. Was that one of your first directing jobs or gigs that you did?
Yeah, that was like my first one. Like,
really? I mean, that's just a pretty good first one. So,
Has Kevin ever showed you the previous for that?
The previous for it?
For that short?
No, I haven't seen it.
You should show him that previous because when Kevin had approached me for it, mm-hmm. and said, hey, I got this idea, it's a sci-fi thing, and I want you to play as astronaut. I was like, oh, yeah, sure, man. I've helped out a lot of friends on a lot of different short film projects, feature film stuff too, independent feature stuff,
sure.
you know, for little money or no money. And I'm always, you know, I always want to help friends out. But you never know what it's going to be like. And,
right.
And, you know, a lot of times people are on, you know, projects, they come out okay. And
yeah.
When he had shown me his previs that he had shot already with Barrett,
right.
I was completely impressed. I was like, dude, this is great, man. You've got the whole thing prevised out already. I'm this is great.
Yep.
Which no friend had approached me with a project that had that level of thought out that have sought out to that degree already. You know, they'll have a script, a rough script,
right,
or an idea, but something that the previews already shot and primarily edited by that point.
Right.
I was like, wow, this is great, man.
Yeah, it makes it so much easier for you to see what the vision of it is going to be, right?
It not only makes it so much easier to for the vision, but when we were filming, Kevin's shot list, I mean, Kevin's very, I mean, you know Kevin for a long time. He's very organized. He's very well planned.
Yep.
So his shot list was down to the lens.
Right.
So we literally knew when we were like 15 to 20 minutes off of schedule when we were shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Which was awesome because we were able to do things to pick up that time.
Right.
And that too is so opposite of even, you know, experienced filmmakers.
They,
you know, people run and gun, especially when it's low to no budget stuff. You know, they very little planning.
Right.
So I literally told Kevin, I said, dude, I said, you are operating as professionally as even like the crew I was with on Future Weapons, you know,
right.
that was, we had stuff shooting all over the world with military crews. We had to run tip top.
Yep. I mean, that's something to be said, especially, you know, if you actually come from a VFX background or whatever, you actually have an idea of how organized you have to be, and you can carry that through in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And it's also just kind of like the unknown. And it's just like, when in doubt, like, you know, just keep planning and do is like go overboard in your preparation. And, that kind of led to that level of organization. And then it also definitely benefited on the back end. Like, you know, when I proactively, I knew like what kind of lenses I had and I was shooting with, and that translated into, you know, how to get better tracks more easily. I didn't have to have somebody on set taking down all this stuff because I already knew from the previous stage what lenses were being used for these shots.
Right. Yeah. Well, we're gonna on the podcast, I think we'll definitely put a link to Grounded so that people can see what that's about. I'd love if it's possible to have the previs. Do you have that online or not yet?
I'll have to dig it up.
But maybe you can dig it up, and by the time we post it, it'll be up there, and we can show people what the previs look
in
like.
In retrospect, it feels pretty amateur.
Well, no, but you know, good. I think if people think need to know. I mean, you know, just like Dan was saying, it's like you need to know how you start so that people have an idea what it's about digital filmmaking. Because I think what's important for us, if we're going to start preaching about the idea of making these types of films, of like, how prepared you have to be. I mean, yes, we're making things easier for people to make films, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily easy to do, right? You still have to come up with a vision and make that happen.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the famous things I remember very, very early on in my career when I sort of just started in doing filmmaking, working in feature films and doing stuff like that. I happened to have gone to a talk by John Waters, right? And he was talking about doing filmmaking, and someone asked a question in the audience, and I said, what do you think about, and this is before even DSLRs, this is just when HD cameras like were starting to become popular. And they said, well, what do you think about the fact that, you know, because he's done obviously a bunch of independent films. And they said, what do you think about the fact that anyone now can go out there with an HD camera and shoot a film? And it's like anyone has that possibility to do that. And he says, well, I think it's amazing. I think it's wonderful that everyone has that capability to do it. Not everyone should. But the fact is that, you know, having those tools available is fantastic and is great, and this is what we want to promote. But you still have to come in with a very complete vision. That fact of being a filmmaker is a big, big idea. And I think
one thing I would piggyback off of, like when you say not everybody should, it's like there's so many people out there that don't know whether or not they should until they try. And I think
what a lot of this great always stuff try, is always try. Yeah. And now it's become the good thing. Let's just put it, the good thing is that everyone can try now, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone can have those capabilities. But when you came to us with Construct, you already had a bunch of that stuff figured out, right? And you was like, I want to do this, and you just needed some ideas on it, and you basically came up and you had a lot of that story figured out.
Yeah, I mean, like. We want to segue into Construct. So I kind of was sitting on those ideas for a while. Like, I was waiting for the right opportunity where all this rendering power and real-time ray tracing would kind of fall into place to be able to implement. And what motivated a lot of this was, I was trained in fine arts, art school. One of the big things that like I did and I loved, like, you know, you try out everything in art school, you know, abstraction, figure drawing, yep. you know, sculpture, whatever, plein air landscape painting. These little like one sitting 2 hour paintings where you just go out and there's the scene in front of you and the light as it happens to fall on the scene. And then you just try and capture it, encapsulate it into this little 8x10 like quickie oil painting.
Right.
And then there it sits. You don't touch it again. It's just like a capture of the moment. And that that idea I love, just the fact that you could be kind of like this conduit of like something outside of you, and then just and it translates through you, through your eye, through your body and eye to this canvas, and that's it. And it's kind of like a passive form of creating art.
Right.
And that's guided a lot of kind of my direction career-wise, like just or what I've strived for the most. It led me back to photography, and that led me to the DSLRs, you know, like 4 or 5 years ago after like years of not doing any photography. It's just like from CG, I was missing the ease at which I could just compose a frame.
Sure.
And photography gave that to me. And,
right.
And then that's how I got back into DSLRs. And then that experience shooting Grounded and the fact that here is a scene that exists independently of like me, but I can capture that and I can like compose with it and, you know, create this kind of, you know, beauty and find the beauty as it kind of evolves and, you know, happens in front of me.
Right.
That was really appealing. And that was what I loved the most from the live action process. There was a lot of other stuff, you know, preparation and like the fact that like, if you don't get it on that day, you're done. Whereas in CG, right. you could always go back in and like sure. redo it or something.
Yep. Yep.
Or redo it more easily than you would with a live action production. So with Construct, basically, like knowing that at a certain point, like all this rendering technology and like, you know, what turned out to be GPU power would like create a situation where you could start to replicate the live action more and create a situation like what I described where the scene could be existing and happening out in front of you, and you as like a passive artist or a cinematographer could capture the scene and,
right.
and it would just, you know, it would be there translated through the renderer in, you know, a fairly real-time manner, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting thing because basically what you're trying to do in a lot of ways is sort of lessen that gap, right? So you're lessening the gap between the CG and the live action process. And mm-hmm. I think that what Darren has done a lot as an actor is to do that. So now you're even giving Darren more direct feedback as to his performance and whatever else is going on.
Oh yeah.
And so that the idea that you had, I mean, I talked about it in another podcast, but basically the idea of like, well, why would you ever need rendering inside a motion builder? Now that it totally makes sense, right? Because that was the idea. It's like you want Darren to see what he looks like. You mm-hmm. want and we obviously there's been a teaser that we made where you can see your own robotic feet. You know you know what that is, right?
Which is still trippy for me after all the years of being a motion capture.
Right. I mean, yeah, so you've always but that's as a CG person, you're not just looking at an OpenGL version. You're looking at what it actually looks lit.
Even this looking into the reflection
right.
of, you know, a mirror that Kevin placed inside the world of Construct.
Right.
Where I'm waving at myself, you know, is this very surreal, like, whoa.
Yeah. It's way wild. More immersive in a way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that was really, really cool. And then at the same time, as a director or a DP at this point, you're actually able to make that happen as well, where you can say, you know what, this lens, you need this lens. So you can make decisions a lot faster yeah. You can make decisions faster, but you also can save those decisions for the time, right? You're not going to say, you know what, I think I'm going to need a 1:8, and then you're committed to that. You mm-hmm. can actually look at it and say, you know what, I think I'm going to need a wider depth of field.
And a lens change is right. one click of a button instead of like a 15-minute like downtime on a
And you can see exactly what it's going to look like. Yeah.
Well, and then the other whole part of this that helps tremendously for the motion capture is with Kevin already having the sort of the stage set, the house built, you know, that where it's all going to take place.
Right.
That helped us tremendously for all of the action because he knew very much, okay, so here's the house, here's the dimensions. The motion capture volume is only so big, so we know we have to do it in chunks.
Right.
To fit so much of the house in the motion capture volume, but we were able to literally map it out and go, okay, here's the front door, here's the stairwell, here's where the back wall is. Great. So for this chunk of action, here's where things lie.
Right.
And then we can operate as if it's like a real environment, because right. now we could see it and be within those dimensions. And when you're doing fight choreography, there's always going to be cheats.
Right.
But when you're doing something within the basic parameters and environment, well, that's great, because it actually will affect your choreography, which is what you want. Just like a real set, you want it to go, all right, well the wall's here, so we'll throw the guy through the wall here, but he'll break through this wall, and then he'll pick up something.
Let's talk a little bit about fight choreography, because I think, I mean, I witnessed you guys doing your fight choreography, and I was, you know, I hadn't seen anything like that before, and it was something kind of unique, and you guys are used to doing that. I mean, Blur material involves a lot of that kind of stuff, and so this is something that to you guys is second nature, but just understanding how that takes place and how you do that. So can you talk a little bit, how do you plan fight choreography, and how do you make that work?
I think Darren kind of, like, I think spearheaded a lot of the modern workflows that we're using at Blur, like on, what was it, the Star Wars projects? Like, you kind of helped really get a lot of people involved and find, reach out to professional talent.
It kind of started back, again, my Navy SEAL mentor, Richard Makowicz, him and another instructor I had named Christopher Hicks, they were, because I'd been training with them in their martial arts, they were the first people that I had brought in from a martial art background to actually bring in, perform, and choreograph action sequences for us for video game trailers. Mm-hmm. And also for an early, not an early project, but a project from a while back. We had worked on Rocky Balboa, the final Rocky. There was a fight sequence that is in the movie with a fictional ESPN show called Then Versus Now, where they pit a game-like simulation of a young Rocky Balboa versus Mason Dixon, who is like the Apollo Creed of the film. So we had to do a bunch of motion capture for that for Sylvester Stallone. We had to work with him. So I had again brought in my instructors to, and I actually worked with them on the choreography on that for a rough pass of what the fight would look like. We presented that to Stallone. He loved it. And then we brought Stallone in with Antonio Tarver, who was who was the real boxer at the time, a champion boxer at the time, playing Mason Dixon.
Right.
And we mixed some of the fight choreo from my instructors with Stallone's and created this whole sequence with them. And so that was how a lot of the choreography began, how a lot of our action began, where I started bringing Chris and Mac in for our projects and working with them in the mocap and choreographing stuff and basically very much acting like a stunt coordinator, where you bring people in, you hire people, and you'll choreograph with them. Eventually, I started performing as well, because as I got more into acting and more heavily into martial arts, it just made sense for me to start performing stuff. And it was on our first Star Wars trailer that we needed a more formal martial arts stunt team that was beyond just a couple of people with skills. We needed very, very skilled weapons and acrobatic type of movement.
Right.
In choreography. So we actually worked with a wushu team, Eric Chen, who is now back in China, but he was a stunt coordinator who had his own dojo, and he had his own stunt team. So we started working with his crew, and then it started taking off more from there, because like anything, the more action you do, it does well, it goes out there. Yeah. Other clients, hey, we want some of that. We like that action. We want some of that.
Right.
And then it was on the second, it's somewhere in between the first Star Wars trailer we did for the Old Republic and the second one. It was really funny. There was a stunt shoot that, well, Tim got contacted by a buddy of his from Sony Imageworks, who is a visual effects supervisor, but also a martial artist, calls him up and says, hey, I got some guys that need a space to shoot some kind of martial art DVD thing. Can we use your mocap room?
Right.
Back when we had the motion capture in our own space in the right. old studio. And so Tim says, look, I don't know really what these guys want, but if you're willing to chaperone them and maybe you can help them with your experience, you know, I'll let them shoot here. And I'm like, okay, sure, put me in touch with them. So I end up connected with these guys that come in on a weekend and they're shooting some kind of martial art DVD thing. And one of the guys ends up being Ho-Sung Pak. Ho-Sung Pak is the original Liu Kang from the Mortal Kombat arcade game.
Wow.
Which was, you know, all sprites.
Right, right.
You know, so they were real people that they photographed and did made these sprites out of.
Right.
And I'm like bugging out. I'm going, how are you?
Yep.
He looks the same.
Right, right. He looks
he's
like
in his
character.
40s, and I'm like, dude, I was a fucking, excuse me, I don't know if I can curse on it.
No, you can curse on it. That's fine.
I was we'll a kid explicit, playing right. this arcade. How do you look the same, man? And he's right. very humble. He's like, oh, no, thanks, man. I'm like, no, really, dude, you're freaking me out right now. I'm right, like, right. what kind of Asian magic is going on? You look the same.
Right, right.
And I bumped into, coincidentally, some other people I knew were on this stunt shoot. And then Philip Silvera was one of the guys in this shoot. And Phil's from New York. He grew up in the Bronx and Queens and Long Island. So we started getting along to New Yorkers. You know, I'm from Long Island, Queens.
Right.
And Phil is very skilled. He's a very skilled. He's a stuntman that he's one of those stuntmen that really does do it all. He's got great martial skill. He has acrobatic skill, but he's also a guy that really does high falls. He really does car hits. He's done it all. And now he's blown up. I mean, now he's literally Phil's stunt coordinating the Daredevil Netflix series.
Nice.
And we've helped usher him to a great place, you know. And
was it the Captain America 2 elevator fight?
Yeah, elevator fight sequence. He's actually the guy that says, "Excuse me," to Captain America, and it's a great fight sequence.
I remember basically on Construct when I had the privilege of witnessing some of the fight sequence that you guys were doing.
And that was Phil and his team.
Yeah, and it was spectacular and scary to watch. And when I saw the rough edit you guys did from it, and it looked amazing. And I'm actually now seeing it. I'm privileged enough to see the some of the rough renders that you're doing, and it's just coming together amazingly. So
you were asking about kind of like how we choreograph the fight.
Yeah.
Well, knowing that, you know, Phil was on board with helping out on Construct and I had, you know, what basically the script of Construct was like a 2-page beat sheet kind of thing. It wasn't like really formally like fleshed out or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, knowing when Phil was going to like be on board, that we had to create, you know, a couple minutes of fighting, I went away and I figured out what are the two or three like main elements that relate to story that need to happen over the course of this fight.
Okay.
And then, you know, we presented it to Phil, and then he kind of went off and just filled in all the gaps in between like the story elements. Yep. And came back.
So it's almost like a dance choreography in a sense.
Oh, it very much so is. I mean, normally a choreographer will, you know, he'll have the parameters of the fight, you know, the story that drives it, and then we'll come up with a slew of ideas that he can present and say, hey, what about this? What about that? What's great about Phil is because I will choreograph with the stunt teams on our projects, is when I started bringing him, I first started bringing him in as a performer.
Right.
And then I made him a choreographer on one of the Star Wars things, and he started bringing his guys in. And it just really blew up from there because they're some of the top talent in there. And Phil is great at embodying character and understanding who these characters are. So it's not just, oh, let me just come up with a cool move. He'll come up with a move that very much suits the character.
Why would that person do that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. And never fancy for fancy's sake, which is something I always always push, and Phil always is great on this, on the same page of, you know, let's not just do a fancy move because it's cool.
Yeah.
It's got to have intention. You know, it's got to be, there's got to be a reason driving this, this choreography.
There's an economy to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's really kind of, I mean, I'm privileged to have seen the early parts of it, and I'm sure people will be excited when it comes out, but this will give them a something to anticipate. But I really think that, you know, that fight sequence is kind of insane. I mean, it really is gritty, and all the props and everything else involved, yeah, because obviously they're on a construction site, so
yeah,
there's all kinds of crazy
the
crap
creativity that comes into play. Like,
oh yeah,
how do you use this?
How do you use this one thing? Yeah, and there's obviously there's a lot of discussion about the humanity of these robots, uh-huh, you know,
yep,
which I think is a kind of an interesting thing because they're almost too human in a sense. It's like they're so robotic,
right,
yet you relate to them so in such a human way. Which I think makes it more interesting in a lot of ways. So there's that wonderful gap of that humanity.
Yeah, and I mean they feel things, and over the course of the fight, you can tell that they respond.
Sure, yeah, and I think let's go back to the acting a little bit on this, because I think this is an important part of it. I mean these are robots. There's a lot of lack of expression in a way, mm-hmm, but somehow we were able to get that expression across in a lot of ways. And we can even see that in the teaser, how you just have two eyes and like a slight and no facial expression to be said, yet you feel the sense of urgency that is in Bill. And by the way, Bill is played by Darren.
Yep.
So Darren is the guy. And so somehow with a complete lack of ability to move a mouth or have a nose or anything else, you feel the sense of, oh shit, something's going to go down. And that urgency is very much felt, and you can sense it in everything that's going on.
No, the eyes definitely do tell a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in the teaser that we put online, I think we didn't have any eye animation.
Yeah, we didn't have eye darts in yet. We did that for the SIGGRAPH one.
Right. And then we revisited it and we added those darts, and all of a sudden, man, it's just like,
I think that it's really, really, really solid. And the thing that's really cool about it is that, you know, you're able to get this all going, and obviously even with all the technology you have at hand, you're still a lot trying to operate in a way that you're doing everything on your own, and you're trying to experimenting with things.
It was interesting. I mean, like, it's almost like, so it's like there's a workflow technology idea that creates limitations that drive the story, and now I'm benefiting from like those very rigid constraints that like the tech like created on the story, because, you know, I forget, some artists at some point said like through like rules and constraints, infinite creativity can like, you know, flow and come from.
Yes, so it's I believe that 100%. I would say that, I mean, the creativity comes from constraints, right? If you're given a set of constraints, then you become more creative because you figure out what you can do within those constraints,
yes,
as opposed to saying you have unlimited possibilities. You're never going to come up with an idea. It's like you have to.
And I probably would have gotten overzealous with what we could do. And, like if we had CPU render farms and infinite RAM and just like it would have just expanded the scope of the story to a point where it wouldn't be like feasible to execute outside of the
studio. You also had access to something that no one else ever did.
Yeah.
And I think that was something that was kind of interesting too, because in the end, what you're able to do is something that people never realize is possible. The biggest thing from our point of view is the fact that you're able to take something that people only thought of as a look dev tool and turn it into a complete filmmaking process. And that is an important thing for people to realize that it's possible.
Yeah, it's like every project that comes through, like, you know, it's like I've been involved in bidding blur projects for years. And like every time there's like a different set of constraints. It's like, we need it by this date, but we can give you this money. Or we only have this money, but you can take that much time on it. Or it has this many assets.
Right.
And like, so you're always weighing like, okay, where can we cut and what are we willing to sacrifice and what kind of returns can we get?
Right.
So in this case, like, it was okay, this is something that I need to be able to kind of execute like on my own.
Right.
And with a certain like technology limit and overhead, like those are the constraints and what can I create from that? And,
right.
But time I can take as long as I want. I mean, ideally not forever, but that was time was like the flexible, like, you know, marker and I could
but
create.
Okay, this is an important part of it because you are very good at setting your own timer constraints, even though you set them yourselves, right?
Yeah, no,
that is an important part of the idea because if I tell you, it's like, hey, what are you going to get by then? You're going to tell me and you're going to execute it. And a lot of people don't necessarily see that. They just sort of say, well, I don't know, I'll try to do this and I don't necessarily do it. You actually set yourself a goal and that's an important part. I mean, I think Darren can agree with
that's,
me on this.
That's why I love working with him.
Right.
And that's why any project he wants me to help on, I'm like, I'm totally down because I know it'll get done.
Right.
Because again, so many people, you know, they want to create stuff and they talk about it and they talk about it and they don't do it or they start it and their deadlines and their goals are completely out of whack. And, you know, I have a few buddies that are like that have that way of like, if they say it, it's going to get done. And Mac, again, who's my buddy, who's an ex-Navy SEAL, is one of those guys. You know, I think Shauna Sky is also one of those guys, an independent filmmaker too, doing his thing. And, you know, if they say, hey, we want to do this thing, I'm in because I know we'll get it done.
And that's been really, I mean, you know, as someone who's helping produce this thing, it's been the best thing ever because I basically say, okay, what can I get for at this point in time to show, or what can we do here? And we've gone through a bunch of those, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't just, the first thing we did is just try to get Construct like teaser done, which was a big push. Big and spread. We got that out there for GTC in March, and that was great. And then suddenly there was other deadlines that started happening, like what are we gonna do for Maji and how are we gonna get that done? Mm-hmm. And then NVIDIA was like amazing because they saw the potential of this and they was like, yes, we'll give you access to, you know, the biggest GPU farm around, right?
Yeah,
so you can get that done. And so now it's like you say, all right, I have that advantage, right? I have to take it or it's going to get lost.
Yeah, right. Of course. You can't sit on it.
So he actually took advantage of it. And NVIDIA is like, all right, we got this done and it's amazing. And now we have a relationship with Doug Trumbull, who is wanting to push it out as well. So those are good things. And so you always take advantage of it. And you did this in spite of the fact that you were working ridiculous hours at Blur at the same time, right? Because you were working on that Halo project during that time, right?
Yep. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, over the course of a year at Blur, you might supervise 3-4 projects. So there's these, you know, pushes and lulls.
Right.
And, you know, every project is different. And usually, like, up until this point, like, in those lulls, I'd be like, okay, like, I'm an artist. I need to create. I can't just, like, sit back and relax and idle. You know, so
if I'm not
doing something at Blur, I'm, like, doing something else. So it's like, that's where, like, I'd be doing the teaser for Construct. But it
invigorates you, right? You get excited about it. If you're a true creative person, like that's what drives you to do whatever you're doing every day. You know? And you use that to an advantage. And the thing that's really nice about, you know, about working at Blur and Tim's support is that he knows that.
And he sees
that, like, if this person doesn't do these type of things, then he's just going to be a guy on the box, right? You're good, or she. And so you're going to be that person that's going to say, yeah. And then he's going to say, do that. And then we'll see where that takes you even more. And so where has that actually taken you at Blur at this point? I mean, at this point, you're actually starting to work more on directing, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the last few months at Blur, there's been a lot of changes. Tim, the creative director at Blur, he landed the Deadpool film that was kind of moving slowly forward at Fox for years. And when it got leaked last summer, and that kind of reignited the potential of that film, and it basically got greenlighted. That, you know, created a huge opportunity for Tim. And, you know, at the same time.
Tim is now going to direct that.
That's formally officially happening.
He's directing that now. So with him directing a full feature film, he's not necessarily going to have time to direct other things, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the goals of the studio is to, you know, move forward and, you know, be able to operate independently of, you know, a film that, you know, Tim might be directing and, right. and just, you know, keep a steady stream of work coming in. And, you know, a lot of kind of, it created a little bit of a vacuum of directorial or creative attention at the very, you know, top of the project. And, you know, that opened up an opportunity for me to, you know, to they asked if I would like to, you know, chip in and help out and start directing Blur projects.
Well, I think that's really great that, you know, Tim saw what you're doing, saw what the opportunities you're doing and allowed you to basically step in to that gap that you, yeah. that you're now be able to direct more things. And then you obviously have a great understanding of the process. You have a great understanding of how to do things like, directing a fight sequence, how to plan that out, how to make that work, and that, and you've proven that in a way. So
I think the typical like evolution of an artist at Blur is, you know, like they're not going to off frequently insert just kind of people off the street or just like kind of hires sure. into these high positions. You know, it's very much kind of like, you know, prove your worth, prove your capabilities, you know, and work your way up into these types of roles. And in doing so, you develop a strong understanding of the process and how to be very efficient at it. Mm-hmm. And then that translating into a directorial role, like when I'm going to write scripts or, you know, bid out or work with the supervisor to bid out projects, you know, I have a very clear understanding as to like where we can be trimming and cutting and diverting resources elsewhere to squeeze the most creative out of, you know, whatever fiscal constraints there are.
Right.
So that's, you know, it's a benefit for the studio, for the work that will be put out, because of it. So, yeah.
Well, I think that's really great. So basically let's think about the idea of what you guys have been doing on Construct and that, you know, you've got an idea of the process that's going. Do you guys really see this process as being the next wave of how you guys going to make animations in a way or work on that idea? I mean, you've already started experimenting with motion capture just on Construct right within the studio, right? So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. The OptiTrack guys are great. They loaned us a temporary like rig to mess around with, the VCS camera rig and Flex 13 cameras. And it's kind of like a sandbox to play with and experiment right. and try and develop. I mean, just not motion capture as it's traditionally viewed, just to right. capture cameras, for the short film, but then also to explore all this V-Ray for motion builder stuff, the RT rendering aspect mm-hmm. of it too. I think from an industry and also just for me and my projects and, you know, seeking ways to get or gain the efficiencies that I'm pretty certain will come out of a mature process like that, where you're able to visualize to such a high degree, you know, what the scenes will look like at the same time you're capturing performances or earlier on in the project. And, you know, how can that, you know, benefit financially the rest of the project if, you know, your modelers know, you know, because you have depth of field now where the attention needs to put, you know, on your environments
sure.
and the animators understand, you know, what's going to be out of focus or what's going to be in shadow.
Right.
And then the lighters have like a template from which they can like, you know, refine and finish like the full final quality product that the, you know, after all the finessing from all the other departments kind of funnel together. So yeah, I mean, like seeing that stuff develop, I'm actively seeking ways to see that maturing. There's only so much I can do, you know, on my own and figuring out a way to kind of insert it into the Blur pipeline and find it something a little more formal, like environment in which to get more development time or attention.
Sure.
You know, that's the next step, I would hope.
Well, yes. And it, I'm, you know, not going to belittle you, but you not necessarily have been on your own. You've been left to be on your own, but we there has been a lot of support you've gotten from people because they've seen, you know, just they've given you a little bit, and then suddenly it's like it's exploded, right?
Yeah.
Because we've seen the products that are out there. Obviously, Chaos Group has been working with you for a long time, and they're trying to give you whatever access you have to this, and then at the same time, NVIDIA has been able to make sure that they get you whatever hardware, and it's gotten even bigger. You know, they gave you just a couple of cards to start with, right? And now suddenly you've got access to the VCA, and even Construct was shown at the big NVIDIA meeting in front of a bunch of people, right? So they're very excited about that. And Box Computers knows exactly what's going on, and they've been promoting your work because they see it. I mean, everyone sees it, right? And even OptiTrack. So actually, let's go back to the OptiTrack thing, because I think there's an interesting thing that happened there. You were using the VCA, the VCS camera, right?
Yep.
And that was an interesting idea. And you were just like, this is my camera, right? In a way, right? And then as that happened, we started to think about more about what's possible. And then there was an opportunity from our NVIDIA relationship to start showing this at SIGGRAPH. Mm-hmm. Live, which was
frightening,
right? We did not have much time on this. So basically, I remember very specifically, he's like, all right, NVIDIA came up to us like, would you like to show this at real-time live, which is their thing where you show the process live. You cannot pre-record it. You have to show it live. And it was a really scary proposition. And so we started, my first thing is like, well, I don't know if this is going to be possible. So I said, let me just ask. And I was really hoping the answer was no. But I went to Vlado and I said, Vlado, they want to show Motion Builder V-Ray running live at SIGGRAPH in front of a lot of people. What do you think? And he goes, well, it's possible. And that's the problem. Vlado always says it's possible. and so we did that. And so all of a sudden, I called off the track and I made sure we had our computers. So we had the Box Computer here, and we got the cards in there, and the Box Computer still was working great. And we got a bunch of OptiTrack cameras, and they were just these little cameras, right? The They're small great, ones, which were really portable and allowed us to just basically troubleshoot it right here live in the lab. Yep. And that was the joke I was saying with Vlad. I was like, do you ever imagine it? We'd be troubleshooting your rendering engine with a motion capture studio in us in our lab. And he's like, nope, I didn't think so. And you're still using those cameras, which is great.
Yep.
But basically at SIGGRAPH, we showed this in live on a stage in front of a couple thousand people, I think was there, right?
Yep.
And that was kind of a little bit scary.
Oh, yeah. And granted, I mean, these are like early alpha builds, and I'm like the only beta tester. And just
you were the only,
And it's just like, you know, we'll crash every now and then. And you would have to do the right five commands with your fingers crossed behind your back and just like to get it to work.
Yeah. They set us up with some really great guys at SIGGRAPH to make sure that everything was working right. Oh, yeah. They literally built a trust system for us to make sure everything was stable, which is amazing. So I really appreciate the guys at SIGGRAPH doing that. And it was a really great demo. And I think it was basically showcasing, not only are you lighting live, you're doing camera lives, you're showing action live, and it was pretty impressive. So I was really, really pleased that we were able to pull that off. And I think that is the future of filmmaking, and I think that's going to be good.
Very much so.
Yeah.
I mean, another thing that I think is kind of being hinted. I mean, one thing that I love about the VCS camera rig is it's got a bunch of like little macro buttons on it where you can bind it to like the record functions in Motion Builder. So like, you know, the need for like an operator isn't as necessary now because you can control all of this through the VCS, you know, controls that are on your shoulder.
Right.
And that idea that, you know, through using certain technologies, like you can reduce complexity, reduce like, you know, artist time or man hours and like with the motion capture that Darren was referencing earlier, where like I had mapped out the fight choreo and we could measure out the volume and where all the steps and the walls and the, you know, 2x4s would be. And that in turn would mean we would get cleaner mocap, which means we wouldn't have to do as many blends and clean up in the animation phase. And so like
less cheating,
reducing like, you know, another department's attention or time, you know, demands on getting a similar result. So a lot of all these ideas of just kind of like, you know, how do you create more efficiencies and be able to kind of bring it back to a small team.
But you're continuing to look at new ideas. I mean, you guys are even thinking about, you know, you have built your own little prototype hardware, right? Were you doing a focus puller?
Yeah.
That was operating.
Mike Hendricks, who's one of the coders at Blur, I asked him if he wanted to tinker with this, and he jumped on board. And one of the guys, David Stinnett, who's actually one of the owners of the company, has a 3D printer. And so what we did is, again, in the interest of replicating a live action set, we built our own little, you know, physical follow focus. And then we were like wirelessly broadcasting commands into Motion Builder, using a Telnet interface. And then we were controlling like the V-Ray camera parameters, you know, like through this follow focus. And
so you have this little homemade device that you're like controlling, and you basically can have one person operating a camera, the other person following focus, because operating a camera and getting the picture is one thing, and following focus, you're distracted. Yeah. So you need that's why on live action sets you have a separate person to follow focus.
And you realize how hard that really is.
Of course it is.
And I mean, like, you know, there's we could figure out like kind of technical, you know, solutions to that. Like we could link the camera target in Motion Builder to the actor's head. Then 90% of the time, that's probably where you're going to focus. So there's those solutions too. But I think, I mean, out of my own curiosity, it's like, I feel like there's this aversion and ignorance to the process of CG from the live action studio folk. And this is an attempt to create a familiarity with how we are operating that they are familiar with. And in doing so, create comfort and familiarity in us as filmmakers.
Yes.
And you know, that's kind of like the ideal end result, is showing that there's all this creativity and potential in the VFX community for telling their own films.
Yep. And I think, I mean, in a lot of ways, I mean, I sort of talked about it in our GPU conversation that we had many months ago, I guess now, but it was the idea of, you know, there are some amazing DPs out there, and they have an amazing ability to figure out what they want to see and how they can do it and work with directors. And what you basically are doing is you're taking all those things that they're used to doing in live action, and you're giving it back to them.
Yep.
And so there is no reason why you can't go on a motion capture stage now with rendering happening as live as it is, and give that ability back to the DP. Yep. You can have a live action DP and say, okay, where do you want your light? And you can make that happen in CG live for that DP to see. So the DP can go in and say, oh yeah, I want to highlight here, and this is how I'm going to shoot it, and I'm going to shoot with this lens. And they can see exactly what it is.
It should be a Kino flow with this white balance. And, you know, so it's like a lot of those concepts trying to implement, you know. It's, I mean, V-Ray is already set up to do all that, you know. So
yeah, of course.
It's about just kind of creating the working conditions and environment that they can relate to.
And then you can focus on being a director, and you don't have to worry about that. And that, and not to remove any of that what happens on the CG side of things, because to be honest, I think that some of the CG guys should operate more like grips and electricians and stuff like that, where they can feel part of that process happen live and get that feedback from that DP, right?
Yes.
So that's if you're, let's just put it in the live action sense of things. If you're a DP and you're shooting something, and you're a grip or an electrician or whatever, and you're working on things, you're learning from that DP, right? And so now if the CG guy is, and the lighter is working with that DP, he or she is learning from that process just even better than they ever were. And so they're going to benefit from that knowledge, and they will turn into a better lighter or even become a DP.
Sure. Yep.
And so I think that's the idea, is like, let's all, you know, get together and learn that process at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that on-set collaboration, you know, between, you know, different skill sets coming from different worlds, from the live action world, from the CG world, and then finding commonalities and being able to, you know, have discussions and interact with the overlap in a motion capture volume, you know, while all this other stuff is happening, the actors are performing, the directors and, you know, the people that are going to sign off on stuff, you know, are present and can, you know, give the thumbs up that this feels like the shot that, you know, I envisioned,
right,
all the way down to the lighting and the camera work. And, you know, that's, I mean, all this stuff is great.
Well, I think what's also interesting is specifically like from the actor's point of view, so that the actor basically can see what his or her performance is going to be and have a better understanding of what you're going to look like on set. And you're also benefiting from the fact that you also understand the animation process, right? Because you're an animation director. So you know how far you can take it in motion capture because there are, even though you're getting a lot of lighting cues and everything else, you also know there's certain limitations, like, okay, I can get this much, but my eyes, you can't necessarily motion capture eyes. And so you know exactly where you're going to do the eye darting or whatever else is going on, or finger, or just the certain subtleties that are not actually going to be captured. So you can get that as well.
I mean, any visual feedback you have in the mocap stage is going to benefit you, because you are in the box. There's nothing, you know.
Right.
You've white walls around you and minimal props.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's completely imagination. It's theater in the round, you know, stage with nothing, you know.
Right.
You know, a lot of people do well with it, but some people don't, you know, and some people really need more of that visual feedback and, oh, so it's this, and, you know, because not everybody comes from the world of reading sci-fi and comic books all their lives and can just imagine this stuff, no problem. They're like, wait, so I'm Wolverine jumping on a Sentinel, ripping his head off. What is that? What?
Yep.
You know what I mean?
You can get that feedback a lot better now, because I think what's interesting also, I mean, like just any actor from perspective, it's like you do your performance, you don't really see how you're lit no matter what's going on. So the only way you can see how that performance do is to observe the retake or see it on the camera, right? And now suddenly you have that ability and do your next take to match that performance and match that look. And he's like, oh, okay, so I don't need to move that forward or whatever. Because then the motion capture volume is like, well, I guess that worked. You know, without the feedback, it's harder to do. So I think it's really nice to sort of give that ability back to the actors.
And then
see that happening.
I mean, there's other stuff that I want to do too, is like, you know, Google Glass. I want to be able to kind of help the actors visualize the 3D scene, you know, in front of them, you know, and be able to see in front of them, like what they are interacting with. It doesn't exist, you know,
right.
They know what avoidances should happen. You know,
that's a great idea. So let's talk about a little bit where, how much further you want to go? Where do you think this is going to lead to?
I think given a few Moore's Law cycle and a lot of access to render power, I mean, it could lead to these amazingly photorealistic virtual worlds that are just, you know, like VR, you interact with, they just exist, and like you are engulfed in them and immersed in them. And then what kind of storytelling can come out of that? You know, who knows? I mean, there's a lot of kind of interest from traditional Hollywood storytellers into this VR process. And I don't think anyone really understands kind of how to harness it from that angle yet.
Nope, I don't think they do.
I think understand where they could be like tapping into this potential more.
There is still a very, very mature way of looking at film, which is through editing and everything else, especially in fight sequences as an example. You know, I mean, you kind of have to make that process happen.
Yeah.
And I think that what you're doing is a lot more like, in a sense, I don't want to diverge from the VR sense of things, but I think that there's an idea of, you know, how that's going to take place, but you now have the ability to take what you're doing and then expand it a little bit more into a more of a 360 environment and more of experiential things.
You know, like location scouting is like one angle that I would look to insert the concept of like virtual reality into a traditional live action or film workflow. Is like,
okay,
you're going to go on set and you're going to like find what time of day works for you and like what angles do you want to shoot, knowing that this is the type of lighting that, you know, so it's kind of exploring the set and finding compositionally what's going to work, and that would inform how you might set up, you know, the shot once the day comes to you know, get the actors in there and light it
and informs your action too.
Yes,
your choreography is going to change depending on your set, your location.
Right, of course.
You can rehearse in a box, but then once you get there, your choreography is going to change when it's like, oh, the walls are tighter, there's more props here.
Right.
The outside's closer.
And it's a little less like, I mean, that's another thing, like, you know, a traditional CG pipeline, like, you know, for instance, at Blur, we find ourselves like reverse engineering good compositions like at the final stages of rendering compositing. You know, it's just like so many OpenGL renders and, you know, grayscale images and, you know, skeletons, and you're not able to see the final quality product in the environment that an artist might have modeled, like, you know, a month ago. And now all of a sudden that's funneled out to 50 shots and you realize that, you know, in 10 shots it's not working and you have to reverse engineer something that's going to look good.
Right.
You know, whereas if you had the capacity to see that earlier, then you could avoid those types of situations and save that time on the back end. You also mentioned editing, which in the VR space, which I think that demo that those guys had done has been released, right?
It's getting there. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I've seen some guys do some editing work using the Rift and
right.
and a filmic storytelling manner,
yep.
pretty successfully. And
yeah,
so I do think that those concepts can carry into
it's a
the
different
VR space.
It's a different form of filmmaking,
yeah.
and I think people don't. They're still exploring that,
yeah.
and that's where we are now. And I think because of technology like the Rift or anything else, even augmented reality, you're gonna experience a different type of storytelling, yeah. and that's a
yeah.
good thing.
I definitely think so.
And it's not to say that what there's still room for both types of stories, right? There's still room for a nice,
for
tight
sure.
shot with a good depth of field. You're not necessarily going to get that in an Oculus, right? Oculus is way more immersive, so you have to sort of let everything happen. And we even talked, you know, when we were talking to Doug Trumbull and when he was talking about the Maji system, right? It's so smooth and everything else that he feels a benefit to having a much wider or much longer field of view, so everything is out of focus because it feels more immersive,
I
like
know.
You're actually
yeah.
in the environment, right?
What are the aesthetic considerations given the medium that you're trying to tell this story,
right.
and that are might be contradictory to what you were used to as a traditional filmmaker,
right?
You know, and yeah, so I mean that's yeah, it's all interesting and.
I think these are all things that are really cool to talk about,
yeah,
especially right. in what we're discussing with filmmaking or digital filmmaking in our group. So,
well, we've talked about even how with the Oculus Rift, because of the way that we're putting Construct together, that we've been trying to keep the fights together as much as possible. So it is like an interactive play.
Yeah.
Where if we have an Oculus Rift, you can now walk around the environment while the action is taking place.
Right.
So now you're not just watching it on a two-dimensional screen with the angles and editing we've chosen. Now you're watching the fight unfold in a three-dimensional space.
Yeah.
And that's kind of interesting and exciting because that's like walking on stage of a play.
Yep.
And walking around it as the actors are performing, you know. That's kind of an interesting concept, you know.
There was an interesting discussion that happened. I was listening to it on The Verge actually, and they were talking about this is in the early days when the early days it's like 12 months ago or whatever. But when the Oculus stuff was sort of emerging, and they were talking about that technology, and there was there's a play, I forgot what it's called. It's in New York, where basically you experience the play more interactively, where it's happening all around you as opposed to being on a stage
yeah.
and seeing it happen.
I think Tim's gone to that.
Yeah, and you basically can, it's happening all over you. So you're basically experiencing a story,
yep.
environmentally speaking, and you can walk around and choose your own way that you're experiencing it.
Yeah. Huh.
And I think that's a way more interesting way of,
yeah.
of thinking about the storytelling, where if you think about an Oculus, another example I have is when I was playing Bioshock Infinite, which is an amazing story, but I was always annoyed by the playing of the game because I just had to finish whatever I was doing to get back to the story because the story was so cool.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just rather just watch the story. So I would
yeah.
almost rather just put on an Oculus and experience
walk
the story,
around.
Walk around and
yeah.
do it because it's such a great story.
Yeah.
That would be I would actually pay money to experience that,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And so seeing that experience and that storytelling, you
yeah.
can make that happen. And I think it'd be really cool.
Well, imagine our history, you know, imagine, you know, walking around an interactive environment of our history, you know. Oh, I want to go back to watching, you know,
right.
early World Wars, you know, and oh, let me go to Pearl Harbor and actually walk around and
yep.
and witness this, you know.
Yeah.
Almost like time travel, you know.
Yeah. And
witness
and
events from a much
and
more
in
interactive
a sense
place,
you do have a lot of games have that ability because
yeah.
you're still playing the game, but you still have control of where you're looking, and with an Oculus, it'd be even better, right? So that just do that. Forget all the, I have to shoot someone to get to the next part. You know, just tell the story that way. And it doesn't have to be shooting someone. That's the other thing. Like, that environment can be anything. It could be a love story. Could be an action story. It could be a sci-fi fantasy, whatever. Yeah. And just experience that the reality. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I think that's a lot of really cool stuff that could happen. But before we get into all that, because I know you guys are, I can just see Kevin's eyes are like shining. He knows exactly what's going on.
I mean, like, basically, like, I'm focused on a traditional short film, but I know that I'll have all this content to explore with these ideas with.
Like, yes. You know, and that short film is fantastic, and we're not taking away from it, because I think it's a really great thing. And I know that you are already thinking that way, and that's why you're in the position you're in right now. But let's just talk about, just real quickly, so that we can, you know, we're getting to the end here, but let's talk about where you're going to go, like, what your goal is to have this short film done, so that people can think about looking forward to it. So
currently the goal, and I'll keep you posted with enough advance, is to finish it up for GTC 2015.
Okay.
And, you know, that will be a little over a year of production, you know, 7-8 minutes long, a nice tight, compact story, not just some fighting. There'll be some nice juicy, you know, story beats, mixed in, and share it with the world. You know, I think everybody that's a creative, you know, they want to share and relate and communicate, you know, through whatever medium they choose, and have however many people, you know, identify with that. And that's a big part of why I do this, is to be able to, you know, take ideas, turn them into something, and then share it with the world, and then, you know, have people respond to it positively, negatively, create discussion. Yeah. That was one of the great things that I loved about Grounded, was it was a very polarizing film.
Yes.
Like, you put it on, like, I put it online, and like, half the people loved it and half the people absolutely hated it. But I didn't realize that they watched it, and they watched it again.
And they wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, and then they wanted to talk about why they didn't like it. And it's that discussion that created, I didn't realize how much I would enjoy seeing that occur.
Yes.
And that's just like, you know, one of the worst things is just to make something and then just have silence. You know, the what's received is silence. And it's, so love it or not, the fact that people react to it is what I've been enjoying.
And they would put a lot of thought into what they were questioning. Well, I don't understand this loop, and why is this and that? They would have these elaborate long questions that sounded negative. Yep. And you're like, you have those questions.
Kevin Easy even has that right now, even on his teaser. It's like, why does a robot need a heart helmet?
Yeah.
And that's fine. But I know that, you know, there's a lot of humanity that's going on with these robots, which, to be honest, you just might as well just let that happen.
The,
you know?
The one thing I got to say, that one of the many things I love working with Kevin, and this is kind of the ideas he comes up with, he does have a great way of bringing humanity back to stuff. Like,
right.
You know, I've seen it on Grounded. I've seen it on Construct. He's always imbuing the story with just a grounded something.
Right.
That is just real, or has just human nature to it, you know, with Construct, with Bill's character and some other things. I'm definitely more the action guy. And it's like, well, let's throw this in and that, and, you know.
Right.
And then he's like, yeah, that's cool, but, you know, but we want to make sure we keep this, because
there's got to be a reason for things,
this is
right?
More. Well, it's not even, there are different reasons.
Sure.
But what's great is knowing that, you know, it's not about, oh, let's just create cool action. It's not about, let's just make this guy a badass. He's also very open to explore and go,
sure,
you know, how about this and that? Like, you know, like when we talked about Bill's potential military background, you're open to that, but without going too crazy with it, he still wanted to, well, yeah, that's cool, but let's keep it grounded in this and grounded in that. And
right.
Human, you know, and not getting too crazy. You know, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, just like layered, you know, building up, like, here's a broad concept that, you know, defines the world. And then how does that kind of influence or define the characters? And then, like, but they're still individuals, and kind of what can they feel and what can they think about that might not be like the same as every other robot or everybody yeah. else. And like, you know, just find a voice and an identity for each one of these, you know, robots or people, and just let them go down that hole and like have their own intimate personal thoughts that just might seem a little, you know, out of place, or there's this little, you get lost for a minute, you know, you take a little journey and you come right back to the core.
Well, I want to go back to the idea of giving these tools and this technology back to the masses, because I think what you're doing is you're basically showcasing that there's a lot of possibilities. And while some people may necessarily look at the idea as like, well, yeah, you had access to some extremely powerful computers yeah. from Box and some really great GPUs from NVIDIA. All of that technology is going to become more affordable and more accessible to everyone.
There's many different things that we're exploring on Construct. Mm-hmm. There are like big grand undertakings, but then there's also, it comes back to kind of just enabling somebody to do this, like just GPU rendering.
The fact that you were able to do this all out of your apartment in Venice is a big deal, right?
But if you could just, hey, here's a short film render on a GPU. What's the benefit? Well, you can render stuff 5 times faster off the bat. You know, just figure out how to render it on GPU and you'll be fine. You know, so it's like at the core, it's like, hey, you can render this like in with one tower, like, you know, just out of your apartment, and you're going to get like 5 times the performance over anything else that you could sit
something
in
your you never had before.
So, and then obviously there's a ton of other avenues that we're exploring too that are just like kind of on a bigger scale. Like, you know, okay, GPU rendering can render stuff faster. Now what can we do with this? And then that led to like rendering 120 frames a second stereo 4K.
Right.
And obviously that's not incredible. Like an independent filmmaker undertaking, they wouldn't do that. It shows the power and capacity of what the core technology we're using.
Yeah, that was the thing. I was talking with Doug. He was like, obviously Doug's been around the business for a long time, but he was actually looking to us, you know, at the age of 81 years old, and he was like, it's like, well, what, why is this different? I mean, what is it better about it? It's like, well, the fact is, like, Kevin is able to do what normally would be reserved for like a WEDA or an ILM, right? And he's able to do it out of his apartment. And that is basically enabling that person to have that amount of render power. And it's not just GPU technology. I think even just cloud rendering is like, you know what? If I have this and I have a really good idea and people see that idea, and you can get good people to fund whatever you're doing, you don't say, all right, I have a good idea. Now I have to hire even if you're a good CG guy, I have to hire an ILM to do it. You can actually do it. Just a render farm is limitless now, in a way, if you have good ideas. And I think that's a good way to work. And even on your own in your apartment with good GPU technology, if you base it on that technology to start with, you can do it. You can get yourself some feedback.
And I mean, this is obviously new, and it's like we're exploring it and. You know, it's like everything, the first time we go about it and it's going to be like a little pricey, but, you know, give it like market saturation and people will start to like pick this stuff up, the development and manufacturing.
And what you're doing is not something simple. You're not doing a box bouncing around, you know, you're doing some pretty hardcore stuff. And so you're just showing people that like, that's how far I can take it by myself with what I have. And you can do something on your own too. So I think it's really cool.
Yeah. And I think it, you know, even though like now, because the bigger part of the short film, we have animators that are, you know, working at Blur, but the teaser, like, we'll always be able to say that teaser is done out of Kevin's apartment.
Sure.
You know, we're sitting next to
each other. But you have extra people working on it, which is fine. I mean, you always are going to have
You're always going to have that. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And but so I mean, you have guys helping out, and that is only because, you know, you're able to show how, and I think that's because you did that, you're able to get more people excited about the project and you're able to get more things involved. The same thing, right? You started off with just a couple of GPUs in your apartment, and it showed up to a point there, like suddenly NVIDIA goes, oh, well, you know what? You're able to do that. What can you do with 12 VCA machines, right? And that's like $1 million worth of hardware. Yeah. They gave you that access, mm-hmm. you don't own that. They just gave you that access, right? So that just allows you, it's like, how much can you push it? How much can you do it? And that's where I think what's really, really cool about it is that they do really good stuff, and people will actually give you access to some amazing talent and amazing hardware and make that push it even further.
The other thing too, like, you know, that I don't think that people think about, and it kind of happens in the visual effects industry of thinking that it's all just software and buttons and just, you know, you have to learn so much of this stuff that even though people are helping and giving you stuff, you still have to spend a lot of time learning how to use all this stuff that you're using. And again, this is another one of the many things that inspires the hell out of me about Kevin, is that he's using a render farm that he's never used before. It's not Blur's farm, you know, and he's downloading and learning all this new software. He's figuring out how to package up 3D Studio Max files into a code to send off, and then...
Well, he's not even learning that. To be honest, he's actually creating the workflow because no one's done this before.
Yeah, exactly.
So no one's done this before. We're figuring it out on a way, and Kevin's like, well, this is what I'm going to do. Can I do this? And yes, it works. So we're all learning from this process. This is part of what's why the whole idea of labs is happening, is like, well, let's just figure it out.
Yeah.
And that's the best part.
But that's what polymaths do.
Yes.
You know, and that's why I always attribute him being like a polymath, because he's always, it's not like, oh, I'm just working on cameras and lighting of my short. I'm producing it, I'm writing it, I'm directing it, I'm putting all this stuff together, and I'm figuring out how to render it on this cloud. Oh, and I'm figuring out how to do stereo. Right. I still remember the first stereo shot he called up. At his place, we were working one Sunday. We would do these Sunday sessions, and he puts together the first stereo shot. We put on the glasses, and we're like, "Whoa, man, it's so cool!" You know, and he figured out how to do all this
right.
stuff. You know?
And I think that's something that's important to say about labs, is that a lot of people have emailed us or said, "I want to be part of labs." But in order to really be part of labs, you kind of have to be willing to just experiment with stuff.
Pioneer.
You got to pioneer. You got to say, I got this idea. This is what I want to do. And if that's a really original idea, that's what we want to be part of. And that's why we did what we did. So I think it's really cool.
It's inspirational.
Yeah. We're kind of getting towards the end here. Yeah. We've got a long podcast, which is good. Yeah. I'm not ashamed. Is there anything else you want to say before?
No, I mean, just the fact that it's been extremely fun to work on so far, and having guys like Darren and a bunch of other people like collaborate.
I'm really glad. I mean, I know. I mean, we've been struggling to try to get this podcast going because you guys are ridiculously busy, and I'm really honored that you're able to find a way in late at night to get this done. And I think it's going to be really cool. So I appreciate you guys. Doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having
us. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah. I just want to say, you know, it's an honor to talk. And honestly, it's fun to get together with Kevin and talk with you about it, because it actually helps us remember the joy that goes into it, because it is a lot of fun. It's a reminder of why we do this. And this is what it's about. And this is the stuff that fuels us and drives us. And we hope fuels and drives other people.
All right. Well, we got a lot to look forward to until March, so.
Yeah.
We'll put this on there. All right, guys. We're going to let the last bucket drop here. Woohoo!